It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
It's like many other loans. When you go to purchase a house, you buy the house and you borrow money. At the point that you need a reverse mortgage or get a reverse mortgage, the proceeds can actually be used to pay off that first mortgage that you have. The requirement of one of these loans is that the reverse mortgage lender has to be in first priority. And to do that, it has to pay off the first mortgage.
And it is a popular misconception out there that one does have to own their home free and clear in order to do a reverse. In point of fact, the majority of reverse mortgages being done today are being done to pay off existing mortgages.
Elder law attorney Sean Majette and reverse mortgage consultant Jim Warnes give us the straight facts and dispel the many myths about reverse mortgages. And during this week's News You Can Use, you'll learn how a Roanoke County Circuit Court judge ruled that a lease provision holding a landlord harmless from any claim filed by the tenant, even if caused by the landlord, was invalid. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 189, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM Richmond Independent Radio and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. Last month, a Roanoke County Circuit Court judge held that a pre-drafted form rental agreement that required a tenant to hold a landlord harmless for damages caused by the landlord's negligence was a contract of adhesion and unenforceable under the Virginia Residential Landlord and Tenant Act. The tenant's personal property was destroyed when the house caught fire after the landlord removed the apparatus for ashes and covered the opening below the hearth with flammable material. The judge ruled that it would be harsh and unreasonable to require a tenant who suffered damages to be unable to recover or to pay a negligent landlord for the damages that the landlord inflicted on the tenant. The judge also ruled that the terms of the lease shocked the conscience of the court and that pre-injury release provisions were contrary to public policy and void. The lease simply was a subterfuge designed to avoid public policy. In addition, the judge noted that the Virginia General Assembly has condemned the practice of a landlord preying on unsuspecting tenants by its enactment of the Virginia Residential Landlord and Tenant Act, and that within it is a provision which says that no lease may limit the liability of a landlord to a tenant. In other news, U.S. immigration laws allow officials to deny applications for lawful permanent residence or to deny entry into the U.S. if the authorities determine that the immigrant is likely to become a public charge. In deciding whether an immigrant is likely to become a public charge, immigration officials review the totality of the circumstances, including an immigrant's health, age, income, education, skills, employment, family circumstances, and affidavits of support. The Immigration and Naturalization Service has issued helpful guidance and a proposed regulation on the public charge doctrine. The guidance clarifies that receipt of health care and other non-cash benefits will not jeopardize the immigration status of recipients or their family members, but putting them at risk of being considered a public charge. the use of all health care programs except for long-term institutionalization, for example, Medicaid payment for nursing home care, was declared to be irrelevant to public charge determinations. Programs providing cash assistance may be relevant in the public charge determination, but even that must be weighed against other favorable factors, such as a person's current income or skills, or the contract signed by a sponsor promising to support the intended immigrant. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegebright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is NCNB Financial Services versus Shoemate. In October and November 1982, Nations Bank of North Carolina garnished a bank account at Premier Bank of Withville, belonging to Joseph Shoemate. Funds in the account included a pension and Social Security disability benefits. The pension was not exempt from garnishment, and the Social Security benefits were exempt, but the entire account was garnished. Shoemate filed a motion to quash the garnishment in the United States District Court, which held that Social Security benefits are protected even if they are commingled in a savings or checking account with funds from other sources. The court went on to say that if a recipient of Social Security benefits commingles the benefits with other funds, he is entitled to protection as to those funds that are reasonably traceable to Social Security income. This has been the law ever since. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and NCNB Financial Services versus Shoemate is this week's case that changed the Commonwealth.
We're here at the law offices of Thompson & McMullen in Chaco Slip, and we are speaking with an attorney in the firm, Sean Majette, as well as a reverse mortgage consultant by the name of Jim Warnes, and we are going to be talking today about reverse mortgages. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Will one of you tell us, first of all, what basically is a reverse mortgage?
A reverse mortgage is a mechanism that allows a senior, defined as someone 62 years of age or older, to convert a portion of the equity in their home into available cash. It is a mortgage. It is not a grant. It's not free money. It is a mortgage loan.
So how is this different than a regular mortgage?
This is Sean, and you never pay it back during your lifetime unless you want to or unless you leave the house as a residence. And there's some very specific rules. But as long as you are living in the home, you don't pay it back.
So that sounds like a good deal. You get money, you live in the home, and you get to delay paying it back. Who can get a reverse mortgage? What are the requirements for that?
The requirements, Marty, are, number one, one must be at least 62 years of age. Everyone on title to the home must be on the mortgage, and everyone on the mortgage must be on title to the home. Secondly, it must be a primary residence. Cannot be a second home, an investment property, or rental property. It must be an owner-occupied primary residence. And third, you must occupy the home. Once you no longer occupy, that can be a termination event on the loan.
Now, do you have to own the house free and clear to get a reverse mortgage, or can you get a reverse mortgage even if you owe some money on the home?
That's one of the most exciting parts to me. This is Sean again. And it's like many other loans, when you go to purchase a house, you buy the house and you borrow money. At the point that you need a reverse mortgage or get a reverse mortgage, the proceeds can actually be used to pay off that first mortgage that you have. The requirement of one of these loans is that the reverse mortgage lender has to be in first priority. And to do that, it has to pay off the first mortgage.
And it is a popular misconception out there that one does have to own their home free and clear in order to do a reverse. In point of fact, the majority of reverse mortgages being done today are being done to pay off existing mortgages.
And as a practical matter, how far down must your mortgage be paid in order for you to get a reverse mortgage? Or is there no really rule of thumb practical guideline?
There no longer is really a rule of thumb because the product has expanded in recent years. It's a function of the age of the borrower, the interest rate of the program they select, and the particular program they select, because we now have two distinct families of reverse mortgage programs. Well, I should point out 99.9% of the market currently is the federally insured home equity conversion reverse mortgage. Everything that we're talking about today, I'm assuming we're directed towards that. There's a small, tiny subset of proprietaries. We're not dealing with those.
So with all of these various types of reverse mortgages, how much cash can you get? Does that depend on the life of the borrower? Does it depend on how much is owed on the house and how much is worth? What are the criteria that go into how much cash you're actually going to get?
All of the above, because they look at the value of the home from the standpoint of repayment as being the only payment source, which is another one of the great reasons to consider the HECM model. These are what lawyers refer to as non-recourse financing. So that the only security that the bank has for repayment is the value of the home. And if for some reason the value of the home isn't sufficient, then the federal government will pay through something called a mortgage insurance premium, or payment through a mortgage insurance policy that you pay a premium for. They will pay the difference. The appraisal process, each house that's going to be considered for one of these loans has to be appraised by the government. And then the government has its own, when I say the government, I'm talking about HUD, has its own metrics, its own computer program that it runs. And it anticipates within the computer model how much the house will appreciate and what the cost of credit will be. And so if you've got an existing mortgage that has to be paid off, some of the money that you would find available in the equity itself will go to pay off that mortgage. If you are 99 years old, then you're probably not going to live to be another 99 years of age, and so you'll get less money if you take the lifetime option, which Jim referred to as the 10-year option, than you would if you were 79 years of age. Finally, it will depend in part on how you take any of these three or four options that Jim talked about. If you would like, you can put it all, as he says, in a line of credit. Some people refer to that as money in the attic. You can get the money out when you need it, and only when you need it. And if you're not going to have an immediate draw, that will be one of the factors that will determine mathematically how much money you'll actually get out of the transactions.
So what happens at the end of the loan? Tell us when the loan has to be paid back.
A repayment is required when none of the borrowers, assuming we have a husband and wife, when the last borrower no longer occupies that home as their primary residence, or in some other cases, if they have failed to pay the property taxes or failed to pay the homeowner's insurance. Those are two requirements along with occupancy in order to keep one of these loans in place. The typical termination event is the last borrower leaves the home through death, sale, conversion of the property to something other than a primary residence. When that happens, that's called a termination event, and at that point, the loan is repayable.
Well, what happens if the last surviving borrower is no longer physically or mentally able to live in the home and has to go into, let's say, assisted living or a memory care unit or a nursing home? I assume that's also considered a termination event?
It is. There's a 12-month clock that starts to run. And so if a person today leaves the home to go into a nursing facility, the person can voluntarily elect to have the property sold now if the person wants to, or to pay the mortgage off if there are other funds to pay it off. Or the person can say, I intend to go back, and as long as the taxes are maintained, as Jim has said, as long as the property is maintained and the insurance is maintained, there are 12 months from the date that the person vacates the home during which it will not be subject to payment, subject to foreclosure.
So essentially there's a 12-month grace period for someone who has to move out for a physical or mental impairment. Is that basically correct?
Well, there's not a requirement technically that they have to move out. I suppose it would be possible that you could keep the loan in force and simply move out because you intended to go down and spend several months with your daughter in Florida. or with your son up in New York. And as long as you come back within the 12-month period and you intend for it to be your residence and you make it your residence, then that will nullify a foreclosure issue and you continue to live in the house. And I suppose, theoretically, you could do it the very next year.
Yeah, that intent to return is key. If there is no intent to return, then the loan is viewed as having being terminated upon the move out, and within 30 to 60 days, depending upon how it's going to be repaid, it may be due. But if there's an intent to return, either because, as Sean mentioned, you've gone to Florida and you're coming back, you've broken your hip, you went into the hospital, you went into rehab, but you're coming back, then you've got that 12-month period to work with.
Okay, so let's assume there is a termination event. How much is owed at the end?
What is owed is all that has been advanced, all of the interest that has accrued on what has been advanced, and also the mortgage insurance premium that has accrued on what has been advanced. That last item may be a little lost in the weeds, but there is an ongoing mortgage insurance premium which is assessed against the outstanding loan balance on a monthly basis in an amount equal to 1.25% annually, and it's assessed monthly, so that also accrues along with the interest. So at termination, principal balance, initial, or any monies that have been advanced during the term of the loan in the case of a line of credit or a term or tenure payment, and then accrued interest and accrued mortgage insurance premium on that.
And what is the accrued interest? I assume that rate goes up and down during the life of the reverse mortgage, or is it set at the beginning and it just stays there?
There are fixed rate products and there are variable rate products. In the case of the fixed rate, that rate is identical. It remains the same for the entire life of the loan. With a variable rate, it can change monthly or annually.
And what's the most that could be owed at the termination event?
Well, there's no limit on what could be owed, but the question is, what do you have to pay? That is to say that you are not under any obligation. That's the beauty of the so-called non-recourse financing. You're under no personal obligation to pay any part of it back. You can fold your arms and let the house stand as the full and entire collateral. So whether you wish to pay it back, or if you die, if that's the termination event, whether your family will wish to pay it back will depend upon one simple question. Is the house worth more than what's owed? Do I want to keep the house? And if I want to keep the house, or if my family wants to keep the house, then the family will then go out and secure the money to pay the mortgage back. How do they do that? Jim, you want to take a whack at that?
Well, there's a number of ways, and I want to clear up another misconception that I run into in the field a lot. The reverse mortgage does not entail the sale of the real estate. It also does not require the sale of the real estate at the termination of the loan. What it does require is the repayment of the loan up to the value of the real estate. That can be achieved through the sale of the real estate, which is most typically the case. It could also be achieved through assets from any other source, life insurance proceeds. It could be a refinance of the real estate with a conventional loan or with another reverse mortgage to pay off the reverse mortgage in question.
And when you say a repayment up to the value of the home, is that value the value of the home on the date of the termination event?
Yes, it's actually determined by an FHA appraisal at the date of the termination event, and the home, if sold, must be sold for at least 95% of that appraised value.
So the home essentially stands good for the loan, and nothing else stands good for the loan, just the home.
That's correct. The borrower could own four other pieces of property and have $1 million stock portfolio and a $500,000 gun collection. The lender has no claim on any of those assets.
How does a reverse mortgage affect public benefits?
It has no effect at all on Social Security. To the extent that you're receiving Social Security as an earned pension benefit, it has no effect on Social Security to the extent that you're receiving benefits as an SSDI, Social Security Disability Income recipient. And at least in the payment feature on a monthly basis, or however it is that you wish to set it up, as long as you don't accumulate funds in your account, it has no impact from a Social Security SSI standpoint. And so it would be possible for a person to own a home, be on SSI. The home value, of course, is not counted for a person who is a recipient of SSI. And then the person could turn the equity in the home into a fund which he can get at any time that he would like to have it. In other words, money in the attic, what I call the line of credit option, or even if you wished, a 10-year option that Jim has described, or a term of years. You would think, well, wait a minute, he's getting SSI, and SSI is designed to supplement income. This is income, at least as it might be broadly defined by Social Security and the SSI rules, but it's not. These are loan advances. These are loan proceeds. And there are letters out there. I think I have them on my website, majette.net, which you can get to through Thompson McMullen's website, which is t-mlaw.com. I think there's an outline that I actually presented for the Virginia Law Foundation on this. There are letters from HUD. There are, as I recall, letters from the CMS people, the people that run Medicaid and Social Security. There's a POMS, P-O-M-S statement about this, that as long as it's a loan proceed, it's not income. So it would be theoretically possible for a person who's had a hard time in the community but wants to stay in the community, having a hard time there, living on $698 per month, to have a home, turn the home, as long as the person is over 62 and meets the other criteria that Jim has already explained, turn that into income, say, of another $500 or $600 per, not income, but money that they can get, of another $500 or $600 per month. So instead of having to subsist on roughly $700, they could do very well perhaps on $1,200. They still own their home. They continue to live in their home until they can't or don't want to live in their home or are not living at all because they die. As long as they don't accumulate proceeds, as long as that they don't keep in their account more than $2,000 per month going over into the next calendar month, it has no impact at all on SSI benefits. The same general rule, and perhaps even with less qualifications, is true in Medicaid. Medicaid takes a very clear position. There are policy provisions in its manual that a reverse mortgage, unless you accumulate the payments that are made to you, a reverse mortgage does not disqualify a person from Medicaid living in the home. Two quick points. Of course, there are lots of different kinds of Medicaid. This that I'm talking about is applicable across the board in Medicaid, including people living at home and receiving waiver services through our community-based grant.
A lot of people have been fearful of reverse mortgages, and they earned this in the past due to their cost. They are considerably more expensive than a traditional mortgage, and this has scared a lot of people away. Several years ago, HUD, recognizing this and wanting to broaden the availability of the program to a wider base, introduced what is called the Saver product, which takes a dramatic amount of closing costs out of the product in exchange for a slightly lower amount of loan proceeds. I won't go into the detail of the percentage and so forth involved, but where with a $200,000 home, the mortgage insurance premium would be $4,000, with the Saver product, it would be $20. It's that order of magnitude in taking cost out up front. So the availability of the Saver product has made it much more cost effective, if you will. The same thing has happened with origination fees.
And I guess finally, where should people go if they want to learn more about reverse mortgages?
On the HUD website, there is a lot of information. If you went to, I believe it is www.hud.gov, and then typed in HECM in the search bar, you will find pages and pages at that website of objective information. Another is www.reverse.org. That's a non-lender-specific website that has a lot of information about reverse mortgages.
Well, thank you to both of you. We have been talking with Sean Majette. He's an attorney at Thompson McMullen in the Shaco Slip, and also Jim Warnes, who is a reverse mortgage consultant here in Richmond. We have been discussing reverse mortgages. Thanks to both of you for being on the show.
This week's Strange But True Law is from Title 66, which deals with juvenile justice. Under Code of Virginia Section 66-65.2, prior to the release of any juvenile, notice of the release must be delivered by first-class mail to the court which committed the juvenile, to the last known address of any victim of the offense for which the juvenile was committed, if such victim has submitted a written request for notification, and to the sheriff, chief of police, and commonwealth attorney of the jurisdiction in which the offense occurred, in which the juvenile reside and in which the juvenile intends to reside. What is strange about this law is that no similar notice must be given when an adult is released. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral for, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. One of the most important documents you can ever sign is a last will and testament. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when Fletcher Cook, Director of Legal Advocacy at Crater Area Agency on Aging in Petersburg, talks about wills, whether you need one, and what happens if you die without one. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.